There's one important thing, I don't know if you're recording or not, but the one important thing is that because of this exhibition, because there's 28 out of the 35-36 paintings that exist, It is an opportunity, one is in a lifetime opportunity to actually see those paintings, because they are stuck in various places like Germany or wherever they are. In this painting, the woman on the left has open mouth because she's talking to the other one. He painted that, but you can't see it at that distance. You have to be really, really close. But this is not a painting that you can just see from the far away and that be done. Because there are details that you can only see very, very close, or you have an online image. So there's a huge controversy about this painting that is going on for the last 100 years at least, whether he has been using a camera obscura or not to do this. I tend to lean to David. Do you know who David Hockney is? He's a painter who loves photography and technology, whatever, probably the greatest living painter on earth. And he has done various experiments. You know, he's as I say, the most famous painter that is alive. He says it's impossible to paint the way that it was painted without using some kind of lens and some technology assistance. And I'd rather believe a famous painter than a million art critics who are saying that no, he was not using anything. It's impossible that he was not using. This painting, as a view, as a landscape, is completely different from anything that was painted in 17th century by anybody in Netherlands or anywhere else.
It's like an 85 minute.
The precision of it, the colors, whatever, it's done by someone who is actually using some kind of technology. Because for us, it looks like a photo.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why it looks like a photo.
Was that accepted at the time, to use technology? Did people object to it?
No, they were doing it in secret. Every painter had his own tricks, right? And even if he was using various assistants, you know, lens of various kind or camera obscura or whatever, they would not share with other painters and certainly not with the public. Like Michelangelo, for example, wasn't using technology, but he was doing, you know, tests of, you know, trying to figure out the hand or whatever. He would systematically destroy every single drawing to make sure that nobody knows what he was using and how he was doing. They were extremely secretive. This is a painting that was purchased by a Polish woman who was in love with art. She married an American millionaire and she managed to purchase this. She was hired as a cleaning woman because if you're an immigrant from Poland in 1980s, that's the job you could get, but she had a degree in art. So when she married him, finally, she bought this. Then she died, and then the most consulted about him. It's extremely unusual because he only has three paintings that are religious paintings.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do religious stuff.
Because at the time, that wasn't too accepted due to Calvinism, right?
No, he was Catholic.
Yes, but Calvinism in the Netherlands didn't really allow for religious paintings to be made as much as the centuries before.
You're right, possibly, but also because he was not very much interested in telling somebody else's story when he could have been telling his own story. And this is telling somebody else's story.
Yes.
It is an interesting painting. You know, he's using all those reds. By the way, extremely expensive reds because they are called chenille reds, which is from little animals that only live in South America, so they were more expensive than gold to bring to the Dutch. And the Dutch did not have colonies in South America, so they had to be pirates to take over a ship with the transportation of colchina from South America by the Spanish. And only if they did that, then they had that red pigment.
How did he have access to this? How did he finance this?
That's the question, because it's very, very, very expensive. But this may have been a commission, which is why you have the subject.
Commissioned by somebody else.
Instructed. Yeah, who wanted to have St. Praxedes, okay? Because he, by himself, on his own volition, did not do religious subjects. Yeah. Which is why the fakes by Hans van Mekre'in were so unusual because they were religious, and he didn't do many religious. There's one mythological, this religious, and there's going to be Christ in the house of Mary and Martha, which is another religious painting. Otherwise, he didn't do religious paintings. So there's one. There's this one mythological, which is very, very, very beautiful, and it's at Maurits in The Hague.
Maurits' house.
Maurits' house. Thank you. Look at the browns. Look at the browns of that. This is like a copper brown. It's very difficult.
Yes, right.
It's very difficult to create that color. Because these are pure pigments. This is the red madder, which is this cochineal that I told you. This is the lapis lazuli. Mm-hmm. This is the ochre. They are easier pigments. They're expensive, but they're easier. This is a mix, and it's very, very hard to do those. And they are two different browns, see?
Yes.
Brown below, and that kind of gold copper brown on this.
And then, of course, the copper brown by itself has different shades.
A lot of paintings of that period are just kind of muddy brown, nothing whatever beautiful. Just look, you know, this is not even his thing. This is an early painting. It's not very, very, very important. It's 1655. It's at least 10 years before his best period.
Wow.
Okay? This is an early painting. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful, the way he did it.
What about the expressions in the faces? Is that characteristic of his time?
The whole thing is not very characteristic of his. This is Diana, right? Mm-hmm. Diana is usually, especially in that period, the portrait is usually of her chasing a deer or having a contretemps with Adonis, who was observing her while she was naked. And in revenge, she turned him into a deer, and then he gets shot by an arrow. That's the story, the mythological story. This is something completely different. She's dressed. She's the woman in yellow, whatever. She is sitting there. She's getting some help from a servant or whatever. And it's just a group of women interacting with each other. There's no hunt here. There's no nakedness. There's not a usual thing. It's just a group of women doing something together. So something that's what he painted all his life. So 20 years of his painting, that's what he paints. Women doing something together. And he does it even in the mythological painting. So it's very,
yes,
very...
So even though it is a mythological scene...
Correct.
The representation of the picture itself is very
He rejects all the canons, because the canon is to have her half naked, you know, with the bow and an arrow and chasing Adonis through the forest.
Do you think that this was part of his unwillingness to draw mythological religious...
That would be my theory.
So even though he got the exercise...
It's a commission. It's definitely a commission.
It was almost like a stubbornness. He said, okay, I will do mythological.
But I will do it my way.
But I will do it my way.
Rembrandt was the same. There's a painting of Rembrandt of the Christ Christ with the disciples. And it's like a close-up, just the faces. Like if you just did the photo of the faces. The rest is rejected because he was not interested in the rest. He also had the problem of doing commissioned religious or mythological paintings that were just like with a canon. If you're an outstanding artist, it's like any musician. Like, you know, look at any major musician. You know, the Sting or, you know, Bruce Springsteen, whatever. They don't do it like every other rocker, right? They do different music. They
Absolutely.
Do different.
Very authentic.
It's the same thing. If you're a true artist, you're never going to do what everybody else does. And this is the other religious painting. And that's why Hank van Mergeren was doing the religious stuff, because he said, well, it's the easiest to fake because there's so few of them, right? It's also fairly early. It's even earlier than Diana, probably. Also a commission.
What about the size of the paintings, though? Because these are fairly large.
Because they're commissioned paintings. And they probably had to fit somebody's mansion. Mm-hmm. And they would give him the dimensions. Because the size of it is typical for either the altar or a mansion, you know, a palace. Like if you see portraits of the aristocrats, they are usually that kind of size. If you look at the Gainsborough, whatever. So this is a commission size, right?
And that would also agree with the pigments being so expensive, is that if you are commissioned, then
you can afford it. There was a crisis for about 10 years in 1600s where there was no cochineal meaning those little animals that gave the red pigment, mm-hmm. at all in the Dutch colonies, I mean, in the Dutch Republic, because there was no shipment from the colonies.
The
monopoly belonged to the Spanish, so unless you took a pirate ship and somehow stole it from the Spanish, you did not have it.
There was no active international trade between the two countries?
No, they were at war, so
yeah,
there was no trade.
Makes sense.
Which is why there's a lot of Dutch paintings of that period that are kind of muddy brown, whatever, because the lesser artists could not afford, unless you had a commission and the patron has paid for it. You have a lot of red here. The other expressive pigment is malachite and lapis, which are used in this painting as well. They are also very, very... lapis comes from Afghanistan, as you know, and it was also more expensive than gold.
Wow.
Malachite came from Germany, so it's a little bit cheaper, but still. So everything... But in the painting itself, I mean, this is a non-religious scene, you know. He comes to the house of Martha and Mary. One of them, Martha deals with serving, being hospitable, you know, a hostess, sourcing food or whatever. But Mary refuses that because she wants to listen to his sermon, which is the woman on the bottom. And the parable, or the biblical story, or the New Testament story, is that it is more important to listen to the word of God than doing the household chores. Yeah. It's a kind of a moral story. But typically, the kind of painting would be done as, you know, there's a lot of happening. You know, you see the whole house, you see things happening, whatever. He just does these three people interacting with each other as if they were people.
What about the blanket? So the figure on the left has a very typical blanket beneath.
Half of the Vermeer is going to have this. This is not a blanket. This is an uşak. This is a Turkish carpet, very expensive. The type of carpet is called uşak. The type of weave, and you will see it in almost every Vermeer painting because he used it heavily as a prop.
As a?
As a prop.
What do you mean by that?
A prop? Do you know what a prop is?
I don't.
In filming, if you have a newspaper.
Ah, so it was just...
It's called a prop.
To fill up the scene.
To make it more interesting, like in the movie.
Yeah.
He's very cinematic. He does a shot. He composes a shot, like a film shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's just the three people with all the primary colors, you know, the red, blue, green, and yellow. It's a very early painting, and he's already very, very good.
Do the paintings of Vermeer ever bear any allegory, any symbolism? Because they're always so...
Not exactly symbolism, but a story. He always tells a story. But this is a commission, so, you know, an artist should not be judged by a religious or commission, for example, because it is almost always... within restraint of the story.
It's not an expression of his own.
Exactly. So I wouldn't spend too much time interpreting a religious painting because, you know, it's a commission. This is one of the first paintings that is a Vermeer painting rather than, you know, I'm doing what they are paying me for. It's called The Procurus. This was... a very popular subject in Dutch paintings of the period, a kind of genre scenes that are also a morality tale. This is the woman in the middle, you know, is the procurer, the one who is arranging a financial transaction between the woman of free-spirited woman, a working woman. There is a client.
The man in red is offering a coin?
Yes, he's a client. You know what he's paying her for.
Ah.
Ah, exactly.
Obviously, by the position of the left hand,
you can tell. Yeah, exactly. Some critics think that the person on the left is Vermeer himself. That is a self-portrait. If you know Rembrandt, you know that there's a lot of Rembrandt portraits that are similar. See it, how the face is half in the shade?
Yes.
Rembrandt came up with this idea. And it has been repeated a lot in Dutch paintings. It is possible that it is a self-portrait, but of course we know so little about Vermeer himself that it could be a model as well, you know. We don't know.
And then again we see the prop. the beautiful,
look
lavishly
at the carpet.
Colored prop. And this one is playing an even more prominent role.
I know. And it's gorgeous. And it's just like, they were extremely expensive, of course. So he could be borrowed. We don't know. Mm-hmm. And also he's showing off. This is one of the paintings that he painted in order to get other commissions. Mm-hmm. So he's a little bit showing off his abilities, that he can paint the fur, which is on the left,
okay.
That he can paint faces different ways, that he can paint a genre painting, that he can do the colors in the most incredible way.
And still use the expensive red pigment. So if this was his way of breaking free, it was quite an investment in
this. This is 1664, I think. I don't know, what's the 1656. So that's a good 15 years before the crisis anyway. So the paint was available. Look at the light in the back. This is lovely. So this is one of the paintings that he painted, a kind of like a calling card. There's a Velázquez painting, a woman cooking eggs, for example, he painted when he was about 19 years old. That was the same thing. It was a calling card. He painted it expressly to show to potential clients what he can do with the paint, you know, the elements that he has. This is one of the paintings. It's hard to see because it's in Dresden. I have seen it in 1979, maybe.
Wow, this is quite a while before we were born, actually. So Nina, what about the level of vulgarism? Is that something that's ordinary for this time?
Yes, that's a part of the genre. That was...
So this was accepted amongst...
It was expected. This is a type of a painting that everybody was expected to do. So he's done it because he's done it. This is after restoration, so nobody has seen this painting as it is. Because it was recently restored. For the restoration, you could not see the Cupid. The curtain was not green, it was kind of brown-yellow. And you just couldn't see any of the details. So this is the first time... that I can see it, but also the rest of the world, since he painted it. This has not looked like this for 300 years. In fact, when you look at books about Vermeer, almost everyone until very recently, the wall is blank. Yeah. Because this is Cupid. So if you have a Cupid and she's reading a letter, then your interpretation could be that she's reading a love letter. And look at the reflection of her face in the window. It was not visible before either. He has a trick very often that the wall is white in the back, meaning light, and there is a dark front. Usually, the convention would be the reverse. The background is dark, and something in the front is light. That's the typical for the period, for the 17th century, 18th century. He's reversing it. Well, he does a lot of tricks, you know, the way he does the shades. He knows that when the yellowish light is coming from the window, the shade is going to be kind of grayish blue, because that's how the nature of light is, because you have the opposite colors. But it was not known in 17th century. He knows it. But it took another 100 years before they figured it out. And really, the person who really figured it out was Goethe, and Goethe is 19th century, not 17th.
So did the size of these paintings shrink?
Yes, because now he's doing his own stuff.
Ah.
He's not doing a commission. He's not showing off to get clients. Now he's doing his own stuff.
And the style changed too, right?
Changes the styles, yes. And he changes the way he paints things.
What do you mean by that?
In his early paintings, he does stippling. Stippling is just like doing little dots in order to create light. Towards the end of his life, he just does what's like strokes. Just like a modern painter almost. So the style of painting changes. This is the painting in which he has originally painted things on the wall. And then he decided that he changes his mind almost in every painting, meaning his final painting is not what he started with. See, the wall is white. There's nothing else happening. But there was more things on the wall that he has painted over.
Oh, really?
Yes, because he decided he doesn't want anything.
To bring out the character more prominently.
Yes, he just does the white wall, and he does the reverse. This is what I was saying before, you know, the reverse.
Yes.
See, the darkness is in the front and the lightness is in the back. This is just the opposite of the convention of painting. He didn't come up with the composition because there are other Dutch paintings earlier than that that he was certain familiar with that have a similar idea of the woman pouring liquid. It's to die for. The Metropolitan has 5 paintings. They lent 2 to the exhibition. 2 lesser ones. So if you really want to see Vermeer's in New York, you have to go there.
The lesser ones got shipped over here.
Yes. Yep. I don't blame them, you know. I don't blame them because, you know, this is very dangerous.
What about the significance of the maps in some of Vermeer's paintings? What do they represent? What is the significance?
Usually it's considered that the maps are used as a prop in order to talk about the world outside, because he does those paintings of something very much that is inside, the internal world of the people that he paints. But sometimes he wants to talk about the link to the external world. So that's the window or the map. So remember I was talking about the stippling? Look at her sleeves, how worked out they are. And they are painted with those kind of
strokes
of yellow paint, right? Mm-hmm. Do you see that? That's not how he painted. 10, 15 years later, he's going to be painting differently. This is before 1660, so maybe in 10 years, he's going to be painting differently.
And on the left, in the window, you usually never see anything from the outside. But here, in the lower left tile,
you see a wall or the city.
You see something, yeah. You see a hint of the
city.
Outside.
It's a hint of city. And also, you know, the way he positions. See how much bigger is this person? They are not very far apart. They are maybe about that much far apart, right?
Yes.
To your eye and my eye, because we are modern and we've seen photography, this is normal. If you're going to take a picture, this is how it's going to look. The person who is close to you is going to be huge compared to the person who is even a little bit more. If it was not photography, but if you just look at this, they would be more or less the same size.
Yeah.
This is a photographic way of looking at it. So apropos of technology, this is a perfect example of technology.
But then that was never confirmed, right, Nina? It was only speculated that
I would rather, believe David Hockney than an art critic, I'm sorry to say. Meaning I would rather believe the famous artist who actually does paint, how things are done. You know, you talk to a chef how the dish is cooked, not to someone who is selling hot dogs, right?
Of course, yes.
This is in Dublin, and it's one of 5-6 paintings that feature letter writing or handling letters. Your favorite carpet is there.
Again, very lavishly apparent.
Absolutely.
What about the classes within society?
Well, you have it in this painting. This is a maid. Look at how little, you know, how her clothing is very modest. And this is a lady who is wearing pearls and silk. And she's married, clearly, because she has a cap and the ability to write.
And they have a painting.
And they have a very nice painting. So clearly, this is 2 different classes. He actually signed here on the piece of paper that is hanging off the carpet, but you cannot see it unless you look at it very closely. Look at the marble floor. Clearly, it's not a poor house if it has a marble floor, mm-hmm. which only came into fashion about 10, 15 years before. They used to have orange and blue tiles on the floor before that. So this is very modern floor for the period. So she's able to afford an expensive floor. We're talking about Tronis. This one is the disputed one, meaning everything is okay in terms of the period that it was created, but the technique is slightly different. The paint analysis is showing some elements that should not be there, so there was probably at least 19th century improvement with pigments that did not exist at the time. The technique is different, the way it is painted, and it is probably, there were 6 canvases that were already stretched that were in the inventory after he died. So it could have been one of those.
And Nina, these two, for the first time since we've been here, we actually look at 2 individuals who are staring directly at the painter, as if they're looking into the quote-unquote camera. The other one, we're all gazing in a different direction, but these ones look directly
at
us.
You are very good at this. You're absolutely right. About in the middle of his painting career, he started changing. Instead of doing people interacting with each other, like the guy in the hat, you know, who's talking to the woman, he started doing the model looking at you. But it was later. So yes, you're right. Okay, this painting you probably have seen. Not a portrait and not a parallel, but otherwise it's beautiful. And it's much bigger than those two.
And again, this is very intimate. It's very...
Well, it's a trony. It's not a real portrait. It's not a portrait and it's not a pearl. There's even a theory that it was one of his daughters. The eldest of his daughters at the time would be about 13. He had two daughters, one aged 10 and one 13, in the whatever year he painted, 1664. So it is possible that it is one of his daughters. He had 11 children. He had something to choose from. Well, a total of 15, but four died, so it was 11. So there's a theory that it may have been one of his kids.
And Nina, this painting is also absent in all the more expensive pigments. The red, for example, is not reflected in this painting.
There's no red here, yeah.
So these are all more widely available pigments, right?
True, but also this is a trony, so this is not for selling or giving to anybody, because tronies were studies, kind of character studies, sometimes done to either show off the skill or sometimes for themselves, not necessarily a commission, sometimes just to test certain things. And they are not portraits of real people, meaning they are portraits of real people, but they are not commissioned portrait. Trony is not really a portrait. It's an exercise in painting, and it's meant to be always a very unusual, exotic costume. It's almost like playing.
Ah. Is this akin to what Da Vinci did with the painting, with the drawings of, say, horses?
Yes, and Rembrandt did a lot of tronies as well, like quite a lot of them, much more than he. You know, we only have four tronies of him, so he may have done more, but, you know, we only have four. And this one is mainly famous because of the movie and the book. If not for that, it maybe would not be that famous. But as I say, it's not a portent, it's not a pearl, otherwise. But it's beautiful, nonetheless. That's a lace maker, which is at the Louvre. The Louvre has four or five of Vermeers. They only lent the smaller ones. They didn't loan the Astronomer, which is the biggest painting, the most important painting of Vermeer at the Louvre. It's a very scary thing to lend a Vermeer outside your walls of your museum.
Of course. Transportation,
potential of theft. That has happened to a lot of paintings, including Vermeer's. So.
Are some of his paintings still circulating in black markets?
Well, there's one that has never been recovered, which is the concert, which was stolen in 1990 from Isabella Stewart Garden Museum in Boston and probably will never be found. You know, all the people who are involved with it are dead, so... This speaks to what you were noticing before. There are no extraneous people around. She's no longer interacting with anything. It's just a close-up of this person.
And the props have disappeared.
Everything has disappeared. He's just kind of focusing on this lady, and everything else is less important.
And the lady is not wearing a cover on her head.
No, she's a young woman, but of an upper class, because the way, you know, she's wearing the lacy thing, and her hairstyle is not of a maid. This is a hairstyle of an upper class woman. So she's doing the lace as, you know, the well-educated ladies were expected to be, you know, very proficient in lace making, but she's not a professional lace maker in a sense that she's earning a living, right?
And on the left side, a pillow is almost...
No, it's not a pillow. This is a container, if you like, for colored yarn that is kept there, that is used maybe for whatever she's making.
So there are threads?
Yeah, they are threads. Yes, they are threads. And she's using the box that she's using, because in order to make lace, you need to have a box that has a pattern and then has like pegs or nails in order to do the lace. And lace is like, you know, weaving things. And that construction, they did the research that this construction was quite modern. So she has a very kind of, she's like the latest computer.
Mm. So requiring access to money to be able to buy that technology.
Yeah. But the lovely thing is that this is normally at the Louvre, so, you know, it came to the Netherlands.
Yes.
And they will not let it out. I mean, this is a very unusual exhibition, because normally the museums in which Vermeer is, you know, from Tokyo to the Louvre or whatever, would never lend it to any other museum in the world. The Rijksmuseum is the only place in the world that they will even consider loaning a Vermeer.
Why is that?
Vermeer is Dutch. The Rijksmuseum is one of the five biggest, most important museums in the world. So yes, for the Rijks, yes. For everybody else, they can just tell them, go and take a hike. So. Now that's the one that is Kaplan's Vermeer. So that's a very, very precious to see. It used to be in Las Vegas as a Steve Wynn collection. But then Steve Wynn, who is like a Las Vegas entrepreneur, hotel owner, he has sold it, and he sold it to Kaplan, so now it's part of the light and thinking.
But Nina, this really seems to be a trend where from private hands, all these different paintings have transitioned to, say, more...
Well, this is the only one left. There are no Vermeers in private hands other than this one. And eventually, after Kaplan dies, I'm sure that he's going to do something with the collection to establish a museum or whatever.
But why is that? Why did they all get lifted out of the free market into locked up into museums?
Well, there's only about 35 recognized Vermeers. So in the last 150 years, you know, every single one of them was snapped by the museum. A painting like this is worth 200 million at least. So who other than the museum is able to buy it?
There's many billionaires who want to flash.
Too late. They missed the boat.
Oh, really?
It's the last one. You know, Picasso is easy. It's 70,000 artworks. You can have a Picasso. You cannot have a Vermeer.
I see.
That's the rarity of... But I have never seen this painting, of course, because, you know, it's been in private hands. I mean, they had it in Las Vegas for a while, but I didn't see it there. And God knows what's going to happen with this.
What is the lady doing in the picture? What is she working on?
She's playing on a virginal. There's three paintings by Vermeer that are playing virginal. Virginal is a proto-piano.
I see.
Early version of a piano. That's my favorite. I wrote a whole article about it.
You did?
That painting is at the Frick Museum, and it's the woman who is writing a letter. Look at this. Look how beautiful it is. If you like Vermeer, look at this.
The Mistress and Maid.
Yes. This is the last painting that the Frick bought before he died. And only thanks to the First World War, because it belonged to a German collector who basically after the war was so poor that he had to sell it.
There's handwriting in this picture, which you said there's only three or four of them, correct?
There are six so-called letter paintings in his body of work. This is one of them, but it's one of the best.
And Nina, what is in the box?
I don't know, letters, jewelry, writing instruments, we don't know that. The most important thing here is that this is a scene, right? Which you can interpret whichever. I mean, what do you see? What is happening here?
I think she's writing something and then gets informed about a letter that just came in.
Exactly.
Something like this. Where she seems very surprised on the right hand, touching her chin.
Maybe she's writing to the guy that, yes, we're going to meet or whatever. And then the maid brings inside that he just canceled.
Perhaps a love letter.
Uh-huh. Could be.
Because the woman on the left looks quite...
That's a maid.
It's almost a grin where she's like...
Maybe, but in any case, she brings some news that interrupts the story. So she's wearing this is called Bedeyaka, this thing. And it was worn by women at the time in the morning, meaning they wouldn't wear it outside. So clearly this is the morning or late at night, but, you know, this is a very private moment.
Baldi also.
So you know that this is an intimate, you know, either morning or evening situation that... It's just between the two of them.
By zooming into the text, can you discern what is written there?
No, he doesn't make it clear, you know.
It's gibberish.
Yeah, in some paintings, he actually signs as a part of, you know, whatever it is. He signs his name, and you can discern that. And in the religious painting, there's some religious sentence there, whatever. But usually you cannot tell what it is. Well, that's the beauty of it. He paints the scenes, but he leaves the interpretation to you. So you can figure out what this scene is actually saying. You know, he's not doing every single detail so that you would have no choice but, you know, go one way. He always leaves it open. Other painters don't do that. So I love this.
What made you write an article about this one?
Looking at it. So it's just like, it deserves writing about. I mean, I wrote about the Frick Museum, but I wrote about this. I mean, just you look at this, you could just imagine that you have it in your living room and you just look at it and look at it. It's just like, it's so incredibly gorgeous. The Frick Museum is in the is being renovated for 5 years. So they lend stuff all over the world.
Ah.
you know, otherwise it would be in storage. So this is a chance. They're going to finish next year, and then there will be no Frick Museum paintings, and they have a fantastic collection.
Where will the paintings go?
To the new building.
So they are continuing their operation?
Yeah. So, you know, when a museum is being renovated, they are very happy to be lending stuff.
Much safer than in a warehouse.
Yeah, and they make money because, you know, they charge for it.
Nina, is this the same woman?
We don't know, but it's the same jacket.
Yeah.
Same casket, same covering, which is the same chair with the Italian carvings, whatever, that he has had in home. So he used it a lot. So the elements are the same. The thing is, in this painting, is that he changed the angle at which the paint, she's holding the quill. It used to be more vertical, as if she was writing. But then they did a radiography not a long time ago, and they figured out that this is now more kind of relaxed. So what it is that he first started painting her writing, and then he changed it, and now she's looking at you. She's interrupted. I'm writing an article that for the quarterly that is going to be about this, and I call it The Girl Interrupted. She's interrupted. She's looking at you. This is exactly what you were saying, you know, that she's suddenly looking at the viewer. She's interacting with you.
Mm-hmm. The previous one was obviously with the lady coming in to deliver a letter, but this one is directly staring at us.
Exactly.
What about the painting in the top left?
I don't remember what it is. He used about two or three that he had at home. One of them is this Cupid that you have seen. The other one is the Procurus, you know, a version of. There's one that is a landscape van Ruysdael, probably, or style of Van Ruysdael. This one, I'm not sure what it is.
It's very hidden. You're not easily able to discern what it is.
Yeah, but this painting used to be lighter about 25 years ago, so maybe this is the varnish that needs to be cleaned again, because it's kind of gone grayer than it used to be. But it's still beautiful. And I love the fact that she's looking at you. There is some theory that this is Katharina Bolnes, this is his wife, but maybe not. They're not so sure about it. But, you know, she was at home. So she had the free model, which was important at the time because you had to pay models.
Would the models sit for the whole sitting?
Well, the trick usually that the painters do is that they have the model sit for something, then they have the mannequin with the clothes, they paint the clothes, and then they call the model back. It's cheaper. Another of my favorites. This is the one that's going to the reportage. It's called The Woman in Blue Reading a Letter. That's the map and the chairs. Remember when I was telling you about the technology? When you have a yellowish light coming in, the opposite color is blue, okay, in the light spectrum. We know that because we deal with the digital technology and we know about the nature of light. But this is 1662.
Sure.
And not 100 years later when they actually knew that, or 150 years later when they really knew about it. He paints this yellowish light coming in, but the shadow is bluish. Mm. So the theory is that he used some lens to understand the nature of light, to understand, because there was no such knowledge at the time.
Were they not able to discern it from rainbows?
Nobody knew. The study of light was done by Anthony Leeuwenhoek, who was also in Delft, contemporary of Vermeer, and probably known him because Leeuwenhoek became the executor of his will, right? So he had some connection to Vermeer. And he was very famous for grinding lens and for studying light. He's called the father of microscope, very famous Dutch scientist, right? They probably knew each other. He probably had lens from him. So there's a lot of backstory to this. But the very fact, you know, to your eye and my eye, this is the way it should be. This is the yellowish light and the bluish shadow. Mm-hmm. You have seen a million times in the digital photography. But this is not digital photography. So this is how beautiful it is. Again, there were other things that he painted over. It wasn't that white wall as it is. Mm-hmm. And he does the same trick that you have a light wall behind and a dark the front, which is again what you see in the photography, things that are up close, if they are not lit properly, they're going to come out like this. So to your 21st century eye, this looks the way it should. To the 17th century eye, things are against the convention, they are wrong. That's what I love about him. But it's more than you see, you know, than meets the eye, so to speak. But for every century, the viewer sees different things. These contemporaries would have seen different things. Van Gogh thought that this is the painting of a woman who was pregnant, and he even wrote a letter to his brother, Theo, right? that I have seen this Vermeer painting, and this is about the woman in blue who is pregnant. The contemporary people saying, no, this is, you know, she has so-called stomacher, which was, you know, something that you put to make the figure more round or whatever. She may be pregnant, but she doesn't have to be pregnant. So in every century, people think different things about Vermeer. I think about digital photography. Van Gogh was thinking about a pregnant woman. Everybody thinks about something else. I love that painting. This one is at the Rijks, so you can come and visit her anytime. I can't, but you can.
Here again, this is very interesting, where the clothing on the right is all, it's there, but it's very hidden, and your eyes are drawn to the center of the picture, which is very much lit up.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. But you see it because this is the trick that he's doing. You know, he's doing all this stuff like a stage, right, on the right, on the left, in order to draw your eye.
Yeah.
Actually, some of his paintings actually have a hole in the middle because that was the way to create a perspective. You put a pin in the canvas, and then you did pieces of string so that you could have the correct angle. See, you have the line between her head and the maid's head.
Yeah.
That goes at a certain angle. So this was the art of perspective. So there's like a painting on the top. This is like maybe Ruys Deel, maybe not. That mop is actually in several other Dutch paintings, his own paintings, so that he didn't completely come up with his own composition. The composition is kind of traditional. But the way to kind of draw your eye and to light this from the left, you know, to do it like this is his. And their interaction is, you know, it's like, because there's a letter there as well, you know. It's called the love letter, but it's probably a misnomer.
And again, the marble floors, which have the geometrical shape is drawing your eyes again to the center.
Correct. There's a lot of, this is like a very geometrical thing. There's a lot of visual composition here. The painting in the behind, you know, the one that he painted is the Procurus, not his Procurus, but, you know, that subject because it was very popular. The Virginal is the kind of proto-piano, and you see it was painted, like the lid is painted, you know, it kind of looks like furniture or whatever. And he painted several women playing this. I mean, he does a lot of paintings with women doing music, you know, the lute, the, you know, the piano, the whatever. And this is one of the two that are in London.
Was there any reason he was painting so many women?
That's a question. That's a Vermeer question. It's like, this is what he liked, you know. This is the, you know, like Renoir, he loved painting women because he loved women the way they look, the colors, the, you know, the skin, the hair, whatever, you know. He was in love with women as the subject.
And I don't blame him.
Yeah, exactly. And he almost never painted men, you know, if he had the choice, because he didn't care about it. He painted children and women. And he talked about it throughout his life. You know, Renoir was interested in painting women. He was not interested in painting anything else. So maybe Vermeer was like this as well.
Sure. So this is not only the Virginal, but also a cello.
Well, it was, you know, remember, there's no internet, there's no television, there's nothing. So, you know, music was a big thing there.
And Nina, this is again Cupid, correct? In the background.
So maybe she's playing some love song, you don't know. This is the one that you can interpret whichever way you want. Well, it's also a prop that he had at home. So the painting to the left is kind of in the style of Ruys Deel. Look at how he did the frame. Look at the lighting, how it hits the frame, including the shadow of the frame.
Yeah.
You're not going to find any other paintings of that period that look like this. You know, look at the shadows from the frame of the window. This is how you get it in the photography, but you don't get it when people just look at it with their eye. With the naked eye, you cannot see it. So he captures something that you can see as through the lens, but not necessarily through the human eye. This is his last decade of his life. He died in 1675, so this is the last few years of his life. So this is a very mature Vermeer. He paints different things because he paints the women facing you, if you like.
Yes.
The technique has changed. There's no more stippling like this and doing little strokes like what we saw before. It is much more kind of flat planes of paint. He's perfect in terms of shadows and lighting now. He's very sure of himself. Mm. You know, he's this very mature painting. And unfortunately, he only lived 43 years, so, you know, he died extremely young. But this is 72, so he has 3 more years to live, and then he will be done. So this is a very mature Vermeer.
So his work, as his career progressed, his work became more mature, more...
Well, he had several stages, but he was developing. He was experimenting a lot. He was, you know, a lot of his paintings are changed. You know, you can see the changes, which are obviously not obvious in the painting, but if you do a radiography, then you can see the pentimento, so you can see how it has changed, right? So he starts with something and then he changes his idea, either the angle of something or things on the wall that I was telling about that he removes. In other words, for him, it's a process of creating, which some artists do by, you know, drawing until they have the... Raphael was doing it like this, you know, the drawings until he had what he wanted to do and then he just painted it. He's different. He's an experimenter. He just paints something and then he paints it over and changes his mind. This is also a joy of doing the oil paintings, because if you don't do oil, you cannot do it in pastel. It's hard to do with tempera, but certainly with pastel you cannot do it. You can do it with oils. Mm-hmm. So it's also the joy of the medium that you can actually change your mind and it's still going to be fine. He's very technical. He has a lot of technical ideas. He's almost like an engineer who is tinkering with things. The optical ideas, the paint ideas, the artistic ideas, you know, he's a mind that is just always in the process. A lot of painters are not like this, you know, either they are like, I am an impressionist and I'm just going to do this like very quickly and then go away, right? And never touch the painting again. That's the impressionist to a great extent. Or they're very cerebral that they are going to, you know, work it out. And then they don't move, you know. Once they have worked out what they want to paint, then you can see it because you have the sketches. Ghirlandaio is like this, for example. There's a fresco in Florence in Santa Maria Novella of the scenes from the life of Mary. And there is a painting of a woman who is coming in, who is a servant and who is pouring water. And it's a beautiful painting, you know, of the woman with the clothes, kind of like a robe that is floating and she's in movement or whatever. It's beautiful. There is a sketch of this painting. He was working it out and working it out and working it out before he did it. But then he is right because it's a fresco. So unless you paint it very quickly...
You get one chance.
Yeah, you get a chance because then it dries out and you're screwed, you know. This is it. For the fresco, there is no, you know, experimenting. Da Vinci tried that and obviously with the disastrous consequences of... Last Supper, you know. This is when you try to experiment with fresco. Yeah, the Last Supper is completely screwed up because he was trying to do with tempera on a wet plaster. Well, you cannot paint with tempera, which is egg-based paint, on a wet plaster. It's just going to be a disaster. So, of course, the whole thing is just started peeling off before he, you know, within 10 years of his, you know, he was still alive and it was already a disaster.
But Vermeer's refinement, in the middle of the painting process.
He tinkers. Mm. I love it in him, you know. He's just like, okay, well, no, this is not what I want to do. Well, there's another theory you can have. The guy had 11 children. Well, 15, if you take into account the 4 that died. He's in a household, one house. Not much money, so not much servants. The guy gets constantly interrupted. He started doing something, and then, you know, he has to put it down and deal with whatever it's that he's dealing with. So maybe the tinkering is also because he just started an idea, then he got interrupted, comes back to it. He only did about 2 or 3 paintings a year, probably. That's the theory. Ooh, this is so lovely. But look, isn't it just the gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous painting?
Wouldn't, I agree.
You know, imagine that you have a bedroom and you have a painting like this. You can look at it forever. The modern art, a lot of paintings, there's no way in hell you would be looking at it because you would just kill yourself if you look at some nightmarish paintings,
sure,
contemporary paintings, right? This you can look at.
What does it mean? What does it do for you when you look at these paintings?
I'm happy. Otherwise, I'm miserable. So this is really the only time that I'm not miserable. Just takes me out of my misery. That's a kind of Ehrlich painting. I don't know. They're not chronological.
I do love this one, though.
Yes.
I think the glass on the
left.
You
know what he's doing to her? Look at what he's doing to her. There's a story there.
She seems agitated.
Yeah, well, look at it carefully. What is he doing, the guy? And also look at the window on the left. it's the only window of his that is so elaborate.
Yeah.
It has a coat of arms, as you can see, in the stained glass.
And again, we see the prop in the middle on the table.
You mean your favorite carpet? You love carpets.
I do, yes.
There's mainly two different carpets that he uses. One is the kind of Turkish ushak, and the other one is a Persian carpet.
And there's also an instrument on the chair.
See the floor? This is the typical floor before the marble one came in. The painting is before 1660s, so the floor is still not marble. This is like this typical of the period in the older houses, but it got replaced later on into this beautiful thing. He uses three different reds in this dress, by the way.
All sourced from the same...
Same cochineal, yes, same animal, yes. In your interpretation, what is the guy doing?
So he's definitely pouring her wine.
Uh-huh.
But she seems a little fed up, a little agitated. There seems to be a sort of annoyment. So maybe he's breaking up with her or he's sharing some bad news.
To me, he's trying to get her drunk. He's standing like this, okay? Look at his arm. And he's kind of looking at her, waiting. Has she had enough alcohol? Is she going to be now compliant or not?
Well, and he brought in the instrument. So obviously, he either already had played a song at the time or is about to do that. Like a serenade.
Maybe, yeah. But to me, he's trying... This is like a rohypnol scene, you know? He's trying to get her drunk to take advantage of her. But you can have any interpretation
sure.
you want, right?
What about the coat of arms on the window? You mentioned that.
Yeah, it's the only window that has that kind of elaborate stained glass in his paintings. It's not exactly sure which coat of arms it is. It could be a religious one as well, but it is very beautifully done. And you can see a little bit of the wall next door, see the brick wall next door, I mean, of the building, which normally you don't see in his paintings. And look at, he did the light hitting the inside of the frame.
Yes.
Which is beautiful as well.
It's very beautiful.
Because no one else paints like this. I guarantee you, if you look at a 500 paintings from the period, they do this, but not as well as he does.
So he was a master of light. Was that because of his relationship that you mentioned earlier to the...
Possibly. Well, he was much more attuned to it, you know. That's what the artist is. There are some artists that are more into something and the others are not. This one is called The Girl Interrupted.
Ah.
And it's also from the Frick. And thank God for the remodeling of the museum, because now we get them all here in one place.
There you go.
They have a temporary place at the Bauer Building in Manhattan, but they are not displaying all of the Vermeers. And now at the Rijks, you have them all.
And again, one of those six that has handwriting in there.
And it's one of those that she's turning her head and looking at you, even though it's a fairly early, because it's before 1660s again. He kind of picked up that thing that he worked out and then started doing singles, because this one is still painting with two people interacting rather than one single woman. But he already has her turning towards you and looking at you rather than looking at him. See?
Absolutely.
So he came up with this idea in this painting, and then he continues, but minus the guy, minus the whole props and stuff or whatever, because there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
There are precursors to this composition in other painters of the period. So he's not the only one who came up with this idea. There's a painting by Metsu that is similar, but he makes it its own by her turning and kind of gazing at you. And he clearly had access to the red, which makes him stand out. Because very soon after, there will be no access to red, so he may have had a stash, because...
Yeah.
Maybe from those religious paintings, maybe he kept some somewhere
sure.
on the shelf, a leftover. That's what I want to think, that he had a stash of red paint
yeah.
somewhere. Now this, there's two paintings. One is called The Geographer, the other one is called The Astronomer. The Astronomer is at the Louvre, and they didn't send it here. They are the same size and the same model and the same kind of position. So the belief is that this is the same person and they were kind of painted more or less together. There is a theory that this could be Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, who is the father of microscope. So there is a theory that it might be a portrait of him, but it could also be a model.
And in this painting on the top right, we see, is that his name?
Yeah. We have no doubt who painted that.
Sure. But that's pretty unique about this.
No, he did sign about 20 of them, but not necessarily visibly. This one is signed very visibly, so you have no doubt. But this is also later. This is his kind of later last decade of his life. So he started signing more. As I say, there's a second painting that is kind of like a companion to this one. Same model for sure. And the subject is what was extremely fashionable at the time, meaning the sciences. This is like just before the Enlightenment, but the kind of the ferment of trying to understand the world around you is already there because of the travels, especially in a place like the Netherlands where the fleet was going all over the world. So an astronomer or a geographer is something that is extremely important for the Dutch Republic.
So it was a well-respected profession at the time.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And very important, right? So the subject matter makes very much sense for the period as well. But he makes it his own by having him kind of look into the world outside. I mean, there's the symbols of the world are everywhere, right? The globe, the map.
Yes.
The compass, everything is about exploration of the world. And he's kind of looking to the outside.
He's contemplating, he's thinking about something.
Yes, usually a painting like this of a scientist or a geographer or astronomer or whatever would be someone turned away from the window and kind of by the table looking at the instruments or maps or books or whatever. He does it the reverse. He flips it. There aren't paintings like this.
And we're looking at a man here, which is also quite out of the ordinary of...
What did you expect, a woman?
Oh, Vermeer, the past paintings we've seen are all women.
Yeah, but there were no geographer women. He has no choice.
So those professions at the time were reserved for men only?
Oh, absolutely. Everything was reserved for the men.
Well, the women got to wear the pearls.
She's actually either putting the pearls on or taking them off, probably putting them on because it's the morning scene in terms of the light. The pearls at the time were not on a string, they were on a ribbon. So actually she's tying a silk ribbon with the pearls. And she's actually looking at the mirror. Next to the window there is a mirror, which we don't see very well, but there is one. It is also, if you study the global trade, there is a Chinese vase on the left that is not very visible, but it's there, thingy, the jar. So clearly this is... a lady in a household that has something to do with a trade.
Sure. And again, the same yellow pajama jacket.
Well, you can read my latest article, which is about the pearls. I talk about this painting, but obviously I haven't seen it. This one is in Berlin.
How did so many of these paintings end up in either Berlin, Frankfurt, all in Germany?
Collectors.
But specifically German?
Yeah, the Vermeer was kind of discovered by Gerhard von Werner, who was an art historian from Germany in about 1860s. So Vermeer was much more popular in Germany in mid-19th century than he was popular in the Netherlands. And then he was popularized by a French journalist, which is what I will be talking about. But not the Dutch. The Dutch were not interested in Vermeer for a very long time.
Yeah. In the middle, down in the center,
there's
a little flock of light coming
Absolutely. This is the guy who looks and sees. And it's at the same time, it's not realistic. I mean, it's a painting, but it's not, like the so-called 19th century realism. This is not that at all. You can make something realistic and not make it in your face 19th century kitsch. That's an NGA painting, which needs cleaning. Probably. They renamed it. It used to be called The Woman Weighing Pearls or something like this, which was wrong. Money did not have a set value in those days. So when you had coins, when you were given a coin, you had to weigh it to know what actually it was worth because they were not standard in any possible way. So in every household, you would have a balance like this and you would have to weigh what you had because otherwise you didn't know what you had, right? She's not weighing pearls. She's probably going to weigh the coins. So it's a financial painting, if you like. I mean, there are precursors to that painting. There are other paintings by other Dutch artists of the period that is the same subject, but not as good as that. Because that painting is not really about weighing anything. It's about her thinking, you know. Look at the tilt of her head. She's thinking. She has some idea in her head. Maybe she's thinking about the money. Maybe she's thinking about what she's going to do with the money. Whatever it is, she's thinking. That's what the subject of the painting is. It's definitely not about the act of counting money.
So, Nina, this painting, if you look at the light coming in from the window, is much more suppressed. It's much darker.
Clearly, it's supposed to show a completely different time of day. This one is the morning toilette, right? She's, you know, tying the pearls, putting it on. It's the morning light that is coming in. She's in a morning jacket. This is late afternoon, probably, something like this. She's contemplating something. She's making a decision about the money that she's weighing, right? Maybe she realizes she doesn't have enough. I love that he just leaves you the interpretation. You can just tell yourself whatever story you want. Usually the paintings, especially the Jean paintings, that is technically that's what it is, they are very much in your face. If you look at Metsu or Steen or any of the Dutch painters of the period, the scene is there. There's no other interpretation. You just have to look at it and believe this. This is different. This is the allegory of the Christian faith.
This is from the 70s, but is a religious one.
Yeah, this is like almost at the end of his life, I think. It's a commissioned painting. It's a very clever painting because he put every single symbol that you can think of and then some into one painting. Like he went all hog. Look at this. There is the evil that is being crushed by the stone in the form of that snake with the blood or whatever. And she's, you know, all over the whole world. So you have the globe. And you have all the, you know, the religious, the cross, the, you know, the monstrous chalice and the Bible and whatever. It's just like the symbol of the world is up there, you know, that glass bulb. You know, every single symbol that he could think of is in that painting.
Obviously, apple on the ground.
Yeah. The apple is another symbol. So like, you know, the original sin, everything that, you know, he just shoved it into all of this. I think he finished like about a year before he died. So he's one of the last paintings. He's very good at what he does. But, you know, I don't particularly like this painting because it's like it's too themed for me. You know, it's just like, well, OK.
It's almost an overkill of symbolic.
For me, it's an overkill.
It's almost a statement that he's making, saying, oh, you want me to paint about religion? Fine, here you go. I'll just put 50 things into one
exactly.
painting.
Exactly. That's exactly what he does. That's what this painting to me is, because it's like normally, as you can see, he tries to do just a few things and very sparingly, you know, clean wall or whatever. He's not a guy who packs the painting with objects too much. Here, it's just like, oh my God, everything was there. That's why I much more prefer the paintings that he painted for himself. A lot of them were unsold, you know, he could not sell them. They were just sitting in his... But, you know, the guy who has, you know, 11 children running around, no money, a mother-in-law who is screaming at him that he's not making enough money and that's not why her daughter married him for, right? Because Maria Fins was not a nice woman from... the texts that we know.
Do you think that he was commissioned to do this?
You know, he converted into Catholicism when he married Katharina Bolnes, and so, you know, he was presumably Catholic. But I have a suspicion that it was a commission of some sort. You know, financially he was doing very poorly, as you know, he went bankrupt.
Well, 10 to 15 children is quite a burden, financially too.
No, the burden was because there was a war and a problem or whatever. So it's not his fault, you know, the country just went apeshit in that period.
Didn't he also run an inn?
His father did. And that house had a huge mortgage. It was a huge house. And the times were very hard. So there's a reason why he was not doing very well. But that's something we're going to be talking about. It is not how the lack of a patron can ruin your artistic output completely.
Exactly.
You know, patrons are important.
But she was financially well set.
Yes, she was quite well financially. She went through three husbands. She sold off his stuff after his death. She did kind of appreciate his stuff because there was one painting she gave to the baker, the allegory of painting that is not here. That's the painting that is in Vienna. She had to pay the debts to the baker. So she gave that painting to him, but with a contract that she has the right to buy it back if she gets the money. And I think she did, but I'm sure she was not very happy that her daughter married a penniless painter.